You go back over the reports. You go back over the reports and you'll see. It was raining or snowing every time. They clawed at him, all right. They fought him. Sure they did. But their fingers just slipped and slid over it.
Who, Johnny? Who?
I don't know, but I'm going to find out.
He stumbled over the lowest of the six steps leading up to the bandstand, fumbled for his balance, and would have lost it if Bannerman had not gripped his arm. Then they were up on the stage. The snow was thin here, a bare dusting, kept off by the conical roof. Bannerman trained his flashlight beam on the floor, and Johnny dropped to his hands and knees and began to crawl slowly across it. His hands were bright red. Bannerman thought that they must be like chunks of raw meat by now. Johnny stopped suddenly and stiffened like a dog on point.
Here, he muttered. He did it right here.
Images and textures and sensations flooded in. The copper taste of excitement. The possibility of being seen adding to it.
The girl was squirming, trying to scream. He had covered her mouth with one gloved hand. Awful excitement. Never catch me. I'm the invisible man. Is it dirty enough for you now, Mama?
Johnny began to moan, shaking his head back and forth. Sound of clothes ripping, warmth, something flowing, blood, semen, urine.
He began to shudder all over. His hair hung in his face. His face, his smiling, open face caught inside the circular border of the raincoat's hood as his, my, hands close around the neck at the moment of orgasm and squeeze.
The strength left his arms as the images began to fade. He slipped forward, now lying on the stage full length, sobbing. When Bannerman touched his shoulder, he cried out and tried to scramble away, his face crazy with fear. Then little by little, it loosened. He put his head back against the waist-high bandstand railing and closed his eyes. Shudders raced through his body like whippets. His pants and coat were sugared with snow.
I know who it is, he said.
10. 15 minutes later, Johnny sat in Bannerman's inner office again, stripped to his shorts and sitting as close as he could to a portable electric heater. He still looked cold and miserable, but he'd stopped shaking.
Sure you don't want some coffee?
Johnny shook his head.
I can't abide this stuff.
Johnny, Bannerman sat down.
Do you really know something?
I know who killed them. You would have gotten him eventually. You were just too close to it. You've even seen him in his raincoat. That shiny, all-over raincoat. Because he crosses the kids in the morning. He has a stop sign on a stick, and he crosses the kids in the morning. Bannerman looked at him, thunderstruck.
Are you talking about Frank? Frank Dodd? You're nuts!
Frank Dodd killed them, Johnny said.
Frank Dodd killed them all.
Bannerman looked as though he didn't know whether to laugh at Johnny or deal him a good, swift kick.
That's the craziest goddamn thing I've ever heard, he said finally. Frank Dodd's a fine officer and a fine man. He's crossing over next November to run for municipal chief of police, and he'll do it with my blessing.
Now his expression was one of amusement mixed with tired contempt.
Frank's 25. That means he would have had to have started this crazy shit when he was just 19. He lives at home, very quietly, with his mother, who isn't very well. Hypertension, thyroid, and a semi-diabetic condition. Johnny, you put your foot in the bucket. Frank Dodd is no murderer. I'd stake my life on that.
The murder stopped for 2 years, Johnny said. Where was Frank Dodd then? Was he in town? Bannerman turned toward him, and now the tired amusement had left his face, and he only looked hard, hard and angry.
I don't want to hear any more about this. You were right the first time. You're nothing but a fake. Well, you got your press coverage. That doesn't mean I have to listen to you malign a good officer,
A man you think of as your son, Johnny said quietly.
Bannerman's lips thinned, and a lot of the color that had risen to his cheeks during their time outside now faded out of his face. He looked like a man who had been punched low. Then it passed, and his face was expressionless.
Get out of here, he said. Get one of your reporter friends to give you a ride home. You can hold a press conference on your way. But I swear to God, I swear to holy God that if you mention Frank Dodd's name, I'll come for you and I'll break your back. Understood?
Sure, my buddy's from the press, Johnny shouted at him suddenly. That's right. Didn't you see me answering all their questions, posing for their pictures and making sure they got my good side, making sure they spelled my name right?
Bannerman looked startled, then hard again.
Lower your voice.
No, I'll be goddamned if I will, Johnny said, and his voice rose even higher in pitch and volume.
I think you forgot who called who. I'll refresh your recollection for you. It was you calling me. That's how eager I was to get over here.
That doesn't mean you're...
Johnny walked over to Bannerman, pointing his index finger like a pistol. He was several inches shorter and probably 80 pounds lighter, but Bannerman backed up a step, as he had done on the common. Johnny's cheeks had flushed a dull red. His lips were drawn back slightly from his teeth.
No, you're right. You calling me doesn't mean shit in a tin bucket, he said. But you don't want it to be Dodd, do you? It can be somebody else. Then we'll at least look into it. But it can't be good old Frank Dodd, because Frank's upstanding. Frank takes care of his mother. Frank looks up to good old Sheriff George Bannerman. Oh, Frank's bloody Christ down from the cross, except when he's raping and strangling old ladies and little girls. And it could have been your daughter, Bannerman. Don't you understand? It could have been your own daughter.
Bannerman hit him. At the last moment, he pulled the punch, but it was still hard enough to knock Johnny backward. He stumbled over the leg of a chair and then sprawled on the floor. Blood trickled from his cheek where Bannerman's police academy ring had grazed him.
You had that coming, Bannerman said, but there was no real conviction in his voice. It occurred to him that for the first time in his life, he had hit a cripple, or the next thing to a cripple.
Johnny's head felt light and full of bells. His voice seemed to belong to someone else, a radio announcer or a B-movie actor.
You ought to get down on your knees and thank God that he really didn't leave any clues, because you would have overlooked them, feeling like you do about Dodd. And then you could have held yourself responsible in Mary Kate Henderson's death as an accessory.
That is nothing but a damnable lie, Bannerman said slowly and clearly. I'd arrest my own brother if he was the guy doing this. Get up off the floor. I'm sorry I hit you.
He helped Johnny to his feet and looked at the scrape on his cheek. I'll get the first aid kit and put some iodine on that.
Forget it, Johnny said. The anger had left his voice. I guess I kind of sprang it on you, didn't I?
I'm telling you, it can't be Frank. You're not a publicity hound, okay? I was wrong about that. Heat of the moment, okay? But your vibes or your astral plane or whatever it is sure gave you a bum steer this time.
Then check, Johnny said. He caught Bannerman's eyes with his own and held them.
Check it out. Show me I got it wrong, he swallowed. Check the times and dates against Frank's work schedule. Can you do that?
Grudgingly, Bannerman said, the time cards in the back closet there go back 14 or 15 years. I guess I could check it.
Then do it.
Mister, he paused. Johnny, if you knew Frank, you'd laugh at yourself. I mean it. It's not just me. You ask anybody. If I'm wrong, I'll be glad to admit it.
This is crazy, Bannerman muttered. But he went to the storage closet, where the old time cards were kept, and opened the door.
11. 2 hours passed. It was now nearly 1 o'clock in the morning. Johnny had called his father and told him he would find a place to sleep in Castle Rock.
The storm had leveled off at a single furious pitch, and driving back would be next to impossible.
"What's going on over there?" Herb asked.
"Can you tell me?"
"I better not over the phone, Dad."
"All right, Johnny. Don't exhaust yourself."
"No."
But he was exhausted. He was more tired than he could remember being since those early days in physical therapy with Eileen McGowan. A nice woman, he thought randomly. A nice, friendly woman. At least until I told her that her house was burning down. After that, she'd become distant and awkward. She had thanked him, sure, but had she ever touched him after that? Actually touched him? Johnny didn't think so. And it would be the same with Bannerman when this thing was over. Too bad. Like Eileen, he was a fine man. But people get very nervous around people who can just touch things and know all about them.
"It doesn't prove a thing," Bannerman was saying now. There was a sulky little boy rebelliousness in his voice that rattled, but he was too tired. They were looking down at a rough chart Johnny had made on the back of a circular for used state police interceptors. Stacked untidily by Bannerman's desk were 7 or 8 cartons of old-time cards, and sitting in the top half of Bannerman's in-out basket were Frank Dodd's cards, going back to 1971. When he had joined the sheriff's department. The chart looked like this. On the left, the list of murders. On the right, Frank Dodd's location. Alma Frechette, waitress. 3 p.m., 11-12-70. Frank Dodd, then working at Main Street Gulf Station. Pauline Toothaker, 10 a.m., 11-17-71. Frank Dodd, off-duty. Cheryl Moody, JHS student, 2 p.m., 12-16-71. Frank Dodd, off-duty. Carol Dunbarger, HS student, 11-74. Frank Dodd, 2-week vacation period. Etta Ringgold, teacher, 10-29-75. Frank Dodd, regular duty tours. Mary Kate Henderson, 10-10 a.m., 12-17-75. Frank Dodd, off duty. All times are estimated time of death figures supplied by state medical examiner. "No, it doesn't prove anything," Johnny agreed, rubbing his temples. "But it doesn't exactly rule him out, either." Bannerman tapped the chart. "When Miss Ringgold was killed, he was on duty." "Yeah, if she really was killed on the 29th of October. But it might have been the 28th or the 27th. And even if he was on duty, who suspects a cop?" Bannerman was looking at the little chart very carefully. "What about the gap?" Johnny said. "The 2-year gap." Bannerman thumbed the time cards. "Frank was right here on duty all during 1973 and 74. You saw that." "So maybe the urge didn't come to him that year. At least, so far as we know." "So far as we know, we don't know anything," Bannerman contradicted quickly.
"But what about 1972? Late 1972 and early 1973? There are no time cards for that period. Was he on vacation?"
"No," Bannerman said. "Frank and a guy named Tom Harrison took a semester course in rural law enforcement at a branch of the University of Colorado in Pueblo. It's the only place in the country where they offer a deal like that. It's an 8-week course. Frank and Tom were out there from October 15th until just about Christmas. The state pays part, the county pays part, and the U.S. government pays part under the Law Enforcement Act of 1971. I picked Harrison. He's chief of police over in Gates Falls now. And Frank. Frank almost didn't go because he was worried about his mother being alone. To tell you the truth, I think she tried to persuade him to stay home. I talked him into it. He wants to be a career officer, and something like the rural law enforcement course looks damn good on your record. I remember that when he and Tom got back in December, Frank had a low-grade virus, and he looked terrible. He'd lost 20 pounds. Claimed no one out there in cow country could cook like his mom.
Bannerman fell silent. Something in what he had just said seemed to disturb him.
He took a week's sick leave around the holidays, and then he was okay. Bannerman resumed, almost defensively. He was back by the 15th of January at the latest. Check the time card yourself.
I don't have to, any more than I have to tell you what your next step is.
No, Bannerman said. He looked at his hands. I told you that you had a head for this stuff. Maybe I was righter than I knew, or wanted to be.
He picked up the telephone and pulled out a thick directory with a plain blue cover from the bottom drawer of his desk. Paging through it without looking up, he told Johnny, "This is courtesy of that same law enforcement act. Every sheriff's office in every county of the United States." He found the number he wanted and made his call. Johnny shifted in his seat.
"Hello," Bannerman said. "Am I talking to the Pueblo Sheriff's Office?"
"All right. My name is George Bannerman. I'm the county sheriff of Castle County in western Maine."
"Yes, that's what I said. State of Maine.
Who am I talking to, please?"
"All right, Officer Taylor. This is the situation. We've had a series of murders out here. Rape stranglings. 6 of them in the past 5 years. All of them have taken place in the late fall or early winter. We have a..." He looked up at Johnny for a moment, his eyes hurt and helpless. Then he looked down at the home phone again. "We have a suspect who was in Pueblo from October 15th of 1972 until, December 17th, I think. What I'd like to know is if you have an unsolved homicide on your books during that period. Victim, female, no particular age, raped, cause of death, strangulation. Further, I would like to know the perpetrator's sperm type if you have had such a crime and a sperm sample was obtained."
"What?"
"It's okay. Thanks. I'll be right here waiting. Goodbye, Officer Taylor."
He hung up.
"He's going to verify my bona fides, then check it through, then call me back. You want a cup of..." "No, you don't drink it, do you?"
"No," Johnny said. "I'll settle for a glass of water."
He went over to the big glass cooler and drew a paper cup full of water. Outside, the storm howled and pounded. Behind him, Bannerman said awkwardly, "Yeah, okay, you were right. He's the son I'd have liked to have had. My wife had Katrina by cesarean. She could never have another one. The doctor said it would kill her. She had the band-aid operation, and I had a vasectomy, just to be sure."
Johnny went to the window and looked out on darkness, his cup of water in his hand. There was nothing to see but snow, but if he turned around, Bannerman would break off.
"You didn't have to be psychic to know that. Frank's dad worked on the B&M line and died in an accident when Frank was 5 or so. He was drunk. Tried to make a coupling in a state where he probably would have pissed down his own leg and never known it. He got crushed between 2 flat cars. Frank's had to be the man of the house ever since. Roscoe says he had a girl in high school, but Mrs. Dodd put paid to that in a hurry."
"I bet she did," Johnny thought. "A woman who would do that thing, that clothespin thing, to her own son. That sort of woman would stop at nothing. She must be almost as crazy as he is."
"He came to me when he was 16 and asked if there was such a thing as a part-time policeman. Said it was the only thing he'd ever really wanted to do or be since he was a kid. I took a shine to him right off. Hired him to work around the place and paid him out of my own pocket. Paid him what I could, you know. He never complained about the wages. He was the sort of kid who would have worked for free. He put in an application for full-time work the month before he graduated from high school. But at that time, we didn't have any vacancies. So he went to work at Donnie Hagar's Golf and took a night course in police work at the university down in Gorham. I guess Mrs. Dodd tried to put paid to that, too. Felt she was alone too much of the time or something. But that time Frank stood up to her, with my encouragement.
We took him on in July of 1971, and he's been with the department ever since. Now you tell me this, and I think of Katrina being out yesterday morning, walking right past whoever did it, and it's like some dirty kind of incest almost. Frank's been at our house. He's eaten our food. Babysat Katie once or twice. And you tell me? Johnny turned around. Bannerman had taken off his glasses and was wiping his eyes again. If you really can see such things, I pity you. You're a freak of God, no different from a two-headed cow I once saw in a carnival. I'm sorry. That's a shit thing to say, I know.
The Bible says God loves all his creatures, Johnny said. His voice was a bit unsteady.
Yeah, Bannerman nodded and rubbed the red places on the sides of his nose where his glasses sat. Got a funny way of showing it, doesn't he?
12. About 20 minutes later, the telephone rang, and Bannerman answered it smartly. Talked briefly, listened. Johnny watched his face get old. He hung up and looked at Johnny for a long time without speaking.
November 12, 1972, he said. A college girl. They found her in a field out by the turnpike. Ann Simmons, her name was. Raped and strangled. 23 years old. No semen type obtained. It's still not proof, Johnny.
I don't think in your own mind you need any more proof, Johnny said. And if you confront him with what you have, I think he'll break down. And if he doesn't?
Johnny remembered the vision of the bandstand. It whirled back at him like a crazy, lethal boomerang. The tearing sensation. The pain that was pleasant. The pain that recalled the pain of the clothespin. The pain that reconfirmed everything.
Get him to drop his pants, Johnny said.
Bannerman looked at him.
13. The reporters were still out in the lobby. In truth, they probably wouldn't have moved even had they not suspected a break in the case, or at least a bizarre new development. The roads out of town were impassable. Bannerman and Johnny went out the supply closet window.
Are you sure this is the way to do it? Johnny asked, and the storm tried to rip the words out of his mouth. His legs hurt.
No. Bannerman said simply, but I think you should be in on it. Maybe I think he should have the chance to look you in the face, Johnny. Come on, the Dodds are only 2 blocks from here.
They set off, hooded and booted, a pair of shadows in the driving snow. Beneath his coat, Bannerman was wearing his service pistol. His handcuffs were clipped to his belt. Before they had gone a block through the deep snow, Johnny was limping badly. But he kept his mouth grimly shut about it. But Bannerman noticed. They stopped in the doorway of the Castle Rock Western Auto.
Son, what's the matter with you?
Nothing, Johnny said. His head was starting to ache again, too.
Sure is something. You act like you're walking on 2 broken legs.
They had to operate on my legs after I came out of the coma. The muscles had atrophied. Started to melt, is how Dr. Brown put it. The joints were decayed. They fixed it up the best they could with synthetics.
Like the $6 million man, huh?
Johnny thought of the neat piles of hospital bills back home, sitting in the top drawer of the dining room hutch.
Yes, something like that.
When I'm on them too long, they stiffen up, that's all.
You want to go back?
You bet I do. Go back and not have to think about this hellacious business anymore. Wish I'd never come. Not my problem. This is the guy who compared me to a two-headed cow.
No, I'm okay, he said.
They stepped out of the doorway and the wind grabbed them and tried to bowl them along the empty street. They struggled through the harsh, snow-choked flare of arc sodium streetlights bent into the wind. They turned into a side street, and 5 houses down, Bannerman stopped in front of a small and neat New England salt box. Like the other houses on the street, it was dark and battened down.
This is the house, Bannerman said, his voice oddly colorless. They worked their way through the snowdrift the wind had thrown against the porch and mounted the steps. 14. Mrs. Henrietta Dodd was a big woman who was carrying a dead weight of flesh on her frame. Johnny had never seen a woman who looked any sicker. Her skin was a yellowish gray. Her hands were nearly reptilian with an eczema-like rash. And there was something in her eyes, narrowed to glittering slits in their puffy sockets, that reminded him unpleasantly of the way his mother's eyes had sometimes looked when Vera Smith was transported into one of her religious frenzies. She had opened the door to them after Bannerman had rapped steadily for nearly 5 minutes. Johnny stood beside him on his aching legs, thinking that this night would never end. It would just go on and on until the snow had piled up enough to avalanche down and bury them all.
"What do you want in the middle of the night, George Bannerman?" she asked suspiciously. Like many fat women, her voice was a high, buzzy reed instrument. It sounded a bit like a fly or a bee caught in a bottle.
"Have to talk to Frank, Henrietta." "Then talk to him in the morning," Henrietta Dodd said, and started to close the door in their faces. Bannerman stopped the door's swing with a gloved hand. "I'm sorry, Henrietta. It has to be now."
"Well, I'm not going to wake him up," she cried, not moving from the doorway. "He sleeps like the dead anyway. Some nights I ring my bell for him. The palpitations are terrible sometimes. And does he come? No, he sleeps right through it, and he could wake up some morning to find me dead of a heart attack in my bed instead of getting him his goddamn runny poached egg because you work him too hard."
She grinned in a sour kind of triumph, the dirty secret exposed in hats over the windmill.
"All day, all night, swing shift, chasing after drunks in the middle of the night, and any one of them could have a .32 gun under the seat. Going out to the gin mills and honky-tonks, oh, they're a rough trade out there, but a lot you mind. I guess I know what goes on in those places. Those cheap, slutty women that'd be happy to give a nice boy like my Frank an incurable disease for the price of a quarter beer."
Her voice, that reed instrument, swooped and buzzed. Johnny's head pumped and throbbed in counterpoint. He wished she would shut up. It was a hallucination, he knew, just the tiredness and stress of this awful night catching up. But it began to seem more and more to him that this was his mother standing here, that at any moment she would turn from Bannerman to him and begin to huckster him about the wonderful talent God had given him. "Mrs. Dodd." "Henrietta," Bannerman began patiently. Then she did turn to Johnny and regarded him with her smart, stupid little pig's eyes.
"Who's this?"
"Special deputy," Bannerman said promptly. "Henrietta, I'll take the responsibility for waking Frank up."
"Ooh, the responsibility," she cooed with monstrous buzzing sarcasm, and Johnny finally realized she was afraid.
The fear was coming off her in pulsing, noisome waves. That was what was making his headache worse. Couldn't Bannerman feel it?
"The responsibility. Isn't that big of you, my God? Well, I won't have my boy waked up in the middle of the night, George Bannerman, so you and your special deputy can just go peddle your goddamn papers."
She tried to shut the door again, and this time Bannerman shoved it all the way open. His voice showed tight anger, and beneath that, terrible tension. "Open up, Henrietta. I mean it. Now."
"You can't do this," she cried. "This isn't no police state. I'll have your job. Let's see your warrant."
"No, that's right. But I'm going to talk to Frank," Bannerman said and pushed past her. Johnny, barely aware of what he was doing, followed. Henrietta Dodd made a grab for him. Johnny caught her wrist,
and a terrible pain flared in his head, dwarfing the sullen thud of the headache. And the woman felt it, too. The two of them stared at each other for a moment that seemed to last forever, an awful, perfect understanding. For that moment, they seemed welded together. Then she fell back, clutching at her ogre's bosom.
"My heart, my heart!"
She scrabbled at her robe pocket and pulled out a file of pills. Her face had gone to the color of raw dough. She got the cap off the file and spilled tiny pills all over the floor, getting one into her palm. She slipped it under her tongue. Johnny stood staring at her in mute horror. His head felt like a swelling bladder full of hot blood.
"You knew," he whispered.
Her fat, wrinkled mouth opened and closed, no sound came out. It was the mouth of a beached fish.
"All of this time, you knew?"
"You're a devil," she screamed at him. "You're a monster, a devil, oh my heart, oh, I'm dying, think I'm dying, call the doctor, George, Bannerman, don't you go up there and wake my baby!"
Johnny let go of her, and unconsciously rubbing his hand back and forth on his coat as if to free it of a stain, he stumbled up the stairs after Bannerman. The wind outside sobbed around the eaves like a lost child. Halfway up, he glanced back. Henrietta Dodd sat in a wicker chair, a sprawled mountain of meat, gasping and holding a huge breast in each hand. His head still felt as if it were swelling, and he thought dreamily, "Pretty soon it'll just pop, and that'll be the end. Thank God." An old and threadbare runner covered the narrow hall floor. The wallpaper was watermarked. Bannerman was pounding on a closed door. It was at least 10 degrees colder up here.
"Frank! Frank, it's George Bannerman! Wake up, Frank!"
There was no response. Bannerman turned the knob and shoved the door open. His hand had fallen to the butt of his gun, but he had not drawn it. It could have been a fatal mistake, but Frank Dodd's room was empty. The two of them stood in the doorway for a moment looking in. It was a child's room. The wallpaper, also watermarked, was covered with dancing clowns and rocking horses. There was a child-sized chair with a Raggedy Andy sitting in it, looking back at them with its shiny blank eyes. In one corner was a toy box. In the other was a narrow maple bed with the covers thrown back. Hooked over one of the bedposts and looking out of place was Frank Dodd's holstered gun. "My God," Bannerman said softly. "What is this?"
"Help!"
Mrs. Dodd's voice floated up.
"Help me!"
She knew, Johnny said. She knew from the beginning, from the freshette woman, he told her. And she covered up for him. Bannerman backed slowly out of the room and opened another door. His eyes were dazed and hurt. It was a guest bedroom, unoccupied. He opened the closet, which was empty except for a neat tray of Decon rat killer on the floor. Another door. The bedroom was unfinished and cold enough to show Bannerman's breath. He looked around. There was another door. This one at the head of the stairs. He went to it and Johnny followed. This door was locked.
"Frank, are you in there?" He rattled the knob. "Open it, Frank."
There was no answer. Bannerman raised his foot and kicked out, connecting with the door just below the knob. There was a flat, cracking sound that seemed to echo in Johnny's head like a steel platter dropped on a tile floor.
"Oh, God," Bannerman said in a flat, choked voice.
"Frank." Johnny could see over his shoulder, could see too much. Frank Dodd was propped on the lower seat of the toilet. He was naked except for the shiny black raincoat, which he had looped over his shoulders. The raincoat's black hood, executioner's hood, Johnny thought dimly, dangled down on the top of the toilet tank like some grotesque deflated black pod. He had somehow managed to cut his own throat. Johnny would not have thought that possible.
There was a package of Wilkinson sword blades on the edge of the wash basin. A single blade lay on the floor, glittering wickedly. Drops of blood had beaded on its edge. The blood from his severed jugular vein and carotid artery had splashed everywhere. There were pools of it caught in the folds of the raincoat, which dragged on the floor. It was on the shower curtain, which had a pattern of paddling ducks with umbrellas over their heads. It was on the ceiling. Around Frank Dodd's neck on a string was a sign, crayoned in lipstick. It read, "I confess." The pain in Johnny's head began to climb to a sizzling, insupportable peak. He groped out with a hand and found the door jamb. "Knew," he thought incoherently. "Knew somehow when he saw me. Knew it was all over. Came home. Did this." Black rings overlaying his sight, spreading like evil ripples. "What a talent God has given you, Johnny. I confess." "Johnny," from far away. "Johnny, are you all..." Fading, everything fading away. That was good. Would have been better if he had never come out of the coma at all. Better for all concerned. Well, he had had his chance. "Johnny." Frank Dodd had come up here and somehow he had slit his throat from the ear to the proverbial ear while the storm howled outside like all the dark things of the earth let loose. Gone a gusher, as his father had said that winter 12 years or so ago, when the pipes in the basement had frozen and burst. Gone a gusher, sure as hell had, all the way up to the ceiling. He believed that he might have screamed then, but afterward was never sure. It might only have been in his own head that he screamed, but he had wanted to scream. To scream out all the horror and pity and agony in his heart. Then he was falling forward into darkness, and grateful to go. Johnny blacked out. 15. From the New York Times, December 19th, 1975. Maine psychic directs sheriff to killer deputy's home after visiting scene of the crime. Special to the Times. John Smith of Pownall may not actually be psychic, but one would have difficulty persuading Sheriff George F. Bannerman of Castle County, Maine, to believe that. Desperate after a sixth assault murder in the small western Maine town of Castle Rock, Sheriff Bannerman called Mr. Smith on the phone and asked him to come over to Castle Rock and lend a hand if possible. Mr. Smith received national attention earlier this year when he recovered from a deep coma after 55 months of unconsciousness, had been condemned by the weekly tabloid Inside View as a hoaxer. But at a press conference yesterday, Sheriff Bannerman would only say, "We don't put a whole lot of stock up here in Maine in what those New York reporters think." According to Sheriff Bannerman, Mr. Smith crawled on his hands and knees around the scene of the sixth murder, which occurred on the Castle Rock Town Common. He came up with a mild case of frostbite and the murderer's name. Sheriff's Deputy Franklin Dodd, who had been on the Castle County Sheriff's payroll 5 years, as long as Bannerman himself. Earlier this year, Mr. Smith stirred controversy in his native state when he had a psychic flash that his physical therapist's house had caught fire. The flash turned out to be nothing but the truth. At a press conference following, a reporter challenged him to. From Newsweek, page 41, week of December 24, 1975, the new Hercos. It may be that the first genuine psychic since Peter Hercos has been uncovered in this country. Hercos was the German-born seer who has been able to tell questioners all about their private lives by touching their hands, silverware, or items from their handbags. John Smith is a shy and unassuming young man from the south-central Maine town of Pownall. Earlier this year, he returned to consciousness after a period of more than 4 years in a deep coma following a car accident. See photo. According to the consulting neurologist in the case, Dr. Samuel Wysak, Smith made a perfectly astounding recovery.
Today, he is recovering from a mild case of frostbite and a 4-hour blackout following the bizarre resolution of a long, unsolved, multiple murder case in the town of... December 27th, 1975. Dear Sarah, Dad and I both enjoyed your letter, which arrived just this afternoon. I'm really fine, so you can stop worrying, okay? But I thank you for your concern. The frostbite was greatly exaggerated in the press. Just a couple of patches on the tips of 3 fingers of my left hand. The blackout was really nothing much more than a fainting spell, brought on by emotional overload, Wyzak says. Yes, he came down himself and insisted on driving me to the hospital in Portland. Just watching him in action is nearly worth the price of admission. He bullied them into giving me a consultation room and an EEG machine and a technician to run it. He says he can find no new brain damage or signs of progressive brain damage. He wants to do a whole series of tests. Some of them sound utterly inquisitorial. Renounce, heretic, or we'll give you another pneumo brain scan. Ha ha. And are you still sniffing that wicked cocaine, darling? Anyway, I turned down the kind offer to be pumped and prodded some more. Dad is rather pissed at me about turning the test down. Keeps trying to draw a parallel between my refusal to have them and my mother's refusal to take her hypertension medicine. It's very hard to make him see that if Wyzak did find something, the odds would be 9-1 against him being able to do anything about it. Yes, I saw the Newsweek article. That picture of me is from the press conference, only cropped. Don't look like anyone you'd like to meet in the dark alley, do I? Aha, holy gee, as your buddy Ann Strafford is so fond of saying. But I wish they hadn't run that story. The packages, cards, and letters have started coming again. I don't open any of them anymore unless I recognize the return address. Just mark them return to sender. They're too pitiful, too full of hope and hate and belief and unbelief, and somehow they all remind me of the way my mom was. Well, I don't mean to sound so gloomy. It ain't all that bad. But I don't want to be a practicing psychic. I don't want to go on tour or appear on TV. Some yahoo from NBC got our phone number, who knows how, and wanted to know if I'd consider doing the Carson show. Great idea, huh? Don Rickles could insult some people, some starlet could show her jugs, and I could make a few predictions. All brought to you by General Foods. I don't want to do any of that S-H-I-T. What I'm really looking forward to is getting back to Cleves Mills and sinking into the utter obscurity of the H.S. English teacher and save the psychic flashes for football pep rallies. Guess that's all for this time. Hope you and Walt and Denny had yourself a merry little Christmas and are looking forward eagerly. From what you said, I'm sure Walt is, at the very least, to the brave bicentennial election year now stretching before us. Glad to hear your spouse has been picked to run for the state senate seat there. But cross your fingers, Sari. 76 doesn't exactly look like a banner year for elephant lovers. Send your thanks for that one across to San Clemente. My dad sends best and wants me to tell you thanks for the picture of Denny, who really impressed him. I send my best also. Thanks for writing and for your misplaced concern. Misplaced, but very welcome. I'm fine and looking forward to getting back in harness. Love and good wishes. Johnny. P.S. For the last time, kiddo, get off that cocaine. J. December 29th, 1975. Dear Johnny, I think this is the hardest, bitterest letter I've had to write in my 16 years of school administration. Not only because you're a good friend, but because you're a damn good teacher. There's no way to gild the lily on this, so I guess I won't even try. There was a special meeting of the school board last evening, at the behest of 2 members I won't name, but they were on the board when you were teaching here, and I think you can probably guess the names. And they voted 5-2 to ask that your contract be withdrawn. The reason? You're too controversial to be effective as a teacher. I came very close to tendering my own resignation. I was that disgusted.
If it wasn't for Maureen and the kids, I think I would have. This abortion isn't even on par with tossing Rabbit Run or Catcher in the Rye out of the classroom. This is worse. It stinks. I told them that, but I might as well have been talking in Esperanto or Igpe Atenle. All they can see is that your picture was in Newsweek and the New York Times, and that the Castle Rock story was on the National Network news broadcasts. Too controversial. 5 old men in trusses, the kind of men who are more interested in hair length than in textbooks, more involved in finding out who might smoke pot on the faculty than in finding out how to get some 20th century equipment for the Psy Wing. I've written a strong letter of protest to the board at large, and with a little arm twisting, I believe I can get Irving Feingold to co-sign it with me. But I'd also be less than truthful if I told you there was a hope in hell of getting those 5 old men to change their minds. My honest advice to you is to get yourself a lawyer, Johnny. You sign that blue back in good faith, and I believe you can squeeze them for every last cent of your salary, whether you ever step into a Cleves Mills classroom or not. And call me when you feel like talking. With all my heart, I'm sorry. Your friend, Dave Pelson.
16. Johnny stood beside the mailbox with Dave's letter in his hand, looking down at it unbelievingly. It was the last day of 1975, clear and bitingly cold. His breath came out of his nostrils in fine, white jets of smoke.
Shit, he whispered. Oh, man, oh, shit.
Numbly, still not assimilating it totally, he leaned down to see what else the mailman had brought him. As usual, the box was crammed full. It had just been luck that Dave's letter had been sticking out at the end. There was a white, fluttering slip of paper telling him to call at the post office for the packages, the inevitable packages. My husband deserted me in 1969. Here is a pair of his socks. Tell me where he is so I can get child support out of the bastard. My baby choked to death last year. Here is his rattle. Please write and tell me if he is happy with the angels. I didn't have him baptized because his father did not approve, and now my heart is breaking. The endless litany.
What a talent God has given you, Johnny. The reason? You're too controversial to be effective as a teacher.
In a sudden vicious spasm, he began to rake letters and manila envelopes out of the box, dropping some in the snow. The inevitable headache began to form around his temples like 2 dark clouds that would slowly draw together, enveloping him in pain. Sudden tears began to slip down his cheeks, and in the deep, still cold, they froze to glittering tracks almost immediately. He bent and began to pick up the letters he had dropped. He saw one, doubled and trebled through the prisms of his tears, addressed in heavy dark pencil to John Smith, Psychic Seer. Psychic Seer, that's me. His hands began to tremble wildly, and he dropped everything, including Dave's letter. It fluttered down like a leaf and landed print side up amongst the other letters, all the other letters. Through his helpless tears, he could see the letterhead and the motto below the torch. To teach, to learn, to know, to serve. Serve my ass, you cheap bastards, Johnny said. He fell on his knees and began to gather up the letters, sweeping them together with his mittens. His fingers ached dully, a reminder of the frostbite, a reminder of Frank Dodd riding a dead toilet seat into eternity, blood in his all-American blonde hair.
I confess.
He swept the letters up and heard himself muttering over and over like a defective record.
Killing me. You people are killing me. Let me alone. Can't you see you're killing me?
He made himself stop. This was no way to behave. Life would go on, one way or another. Life would most certainly go on. Johnny started back to the house, wondering what he could do now. Perhaps something would come along. At any rate, it fulfilled his mother's prophecy. If God had had a mission for him, then he had done it. No matter now that it had been a kamikaze mission, he had done it. He was quits. Part 2. The Laughing Tiger. Chapter 17. 1. The boy read slowly, following the words with his finger. His long brown football player's leg stretched out on the chaise by the pool in the bright, clear light of June. Of course, young Danny Juniper was dead, and I suppose that there were few in the world who would say he had not few in the world who would say he had not deserved his death, Johnny Smith said. Only a slightly fancy way of saying that most would agree that Danny's death was a good thing. Chuck was looking at him, and the familiar mix of emotions was crossing his usually pleasant face. Amusement, resentment, embarrassment, and a trace of sullenness. Lenny sighed and looked down at the Max brand Western again. Deserved his death. But it was my great tragedy, Johnny supplied. But it was my great tragedy that he had died just as he was about to redeem some of his evil work by one great service to the world. Of course Chuck closed the book, looked up at Johnny, and smiled brilliantly. Let's quit for the day, Johnny. What do you say? Chuck's smile was his most winning, the one that had probably tumbled cheerleaders into bed all over New Hampshire. Doesn't that pool look good? You bet it does. The sweat is running right off your skinny, malnourished little bod. Johnny had to admit, at least to himself, that the pool did look good. The first couple of weeks of the bicentennial summer of 76 had been uncommonly hot and sticky. From behind them, around on the other side of the big, gracious White House, came the soporific drone of the riding lawnmower as Go Fat, the Vietnamese groundsman, mowed what Chuck called the front 40. It was a sound that made you want to drink two glasses of cold lemonade and then nod off to sleep. No derogatory comments about my skinny bod, he said. Besides, we just started the chapter. Sure, but we read two before it, wheedling. Johnny sighed. Usually he could keep Chuck at it, but not this afternoon. And today the kid had fought his way gamely through the way John Sherburn had set up his net of guards around the Amity Jail and the way the evil Red Hawk had broken through and killed Danny Juniper. Yeah, well, just finish this page then, he said. That word you're stuck on sickened. No teeth in that one, Chuck. Good man, the grin widened. And no questions, right? Well, maybe just a few. Chuck scowled, but it was a put-on. He was getting off easy and knew it. He opened the paperback with the picture of the gunslinger shouldering his way through a set of saloon bat wings again and began to read in his slow, halting voice, a voice so different from his normal speaking voice that it could have belonged to a different young man altogether. Of course that sickened me at once, but it was nothing to what waited for me at the bedside of poor Tom Kenyon. He had been shot through the body and he was fast drying when I... Dying, Johnny said quietly. Context, Chuck. Read for context. Fast drying, Chuck said and giggled. Then he resumed. And he was fast dying when I arrived. Johnny felt a sadness for Chuck steal over him as he watched the boy, hunched over the paperback copy of Fire Brain, a good oat opera that should have read like the wind, and instead... Here was Chuck following Max Brand's simple point-to-point prose with a laboriously moving finger. His father, Roger Chatsworth, owned Chatsworth Mills and Weaving, a very big deal indeed in southern New Hampshire. He owned this 16-room house in Durham, and there were five people on the staff, including Go Fat,
who went down to Portsmouth once a week to take United States citizenship classes. Chatsworth drove a restored 1957 Cadillac convertible. His wife, a sweet, clear-eyed woman of 42, drove a Mercedes. Chuck had a Corvette. The family fortune was in the neighborhood of $5 million. And Chuck at 17 was what God had really meant when he breathed life into the clay, Johnny often thought. He was a physically lovely human being. He stood 6'2" and weighed a good muscular 190 pounds. His face was perhaps not quite interesting enough to be truly handsome, but it was acne and pimple-free and set off by a pair of striking green eyes, which had caused Johnny to think that the only other person he knew with really green eyes was Sarah Hazlett. At his high school, Chuck was the apotheosis of the BMOC, almost ridiculously so. He was captain of the baseball and football teams, president of the junior class during the school year just ended, and president-elect of the student council this coming fall. And most amazing of all, none of it had gone to his head. In the words of Herb Smith, who had been down once to check out Johnny's new digs, Chuck was a regular guy. Herb had no higher accolade in his vocabulary. In addition, he was someday going to be an exceedingly rich regular guy. And here he sat, bent grimly over his book like a machine gunner at a lonely outpost, shooting the words down one by one as they came at him. He had taken Max Brand's exciting, fast-moving story of drifting John Firebrain Sherburne and his confrontation with the outlaw Comanche Redhawk and had turned it into something that sounded every bit as exciting as a trade advertisement for semiconductors or radio components. But Chuck wasn't stupid. His math grades were good, his retentive memory was excellent, and he was manually adept. His problem was that he had great difficulty storing printed words. His oral vocabulary was fine, and he could grasp the theory of phonics, but apparently not its practice. And he would sometimes reel a sentence off flawlessly and then come up totally blank when you asked him to rephrase it. His father had been afraid that Chuck was dyslexic, but Johnny didn't think so. He had never met a dyslexic child that he was aware of, although many parents seized on the word to explain or excuse the reading problems of their children. Chuck's problem seemed more general, a loose, across-the-board reading phobia. It was a problem that had become more and more apparent over the last 5 years of Chuck's schooling, but his parents had only begun to take it seriously, as Chuck had, when his sports eligibility became endangered. And that was not the worst of it. This winter would be Chuck's last good chance to take the Scholastic Achievement Tests, if he expected to start college in the fall of 1977. The maths were not much of a problem, but the rest of the exam, well, if he could have the questions read aloud to him, he would do an average to good job. 500s, no sweat. But they don't let you bring a reader with you when you take the SATs. Not even if your dad is a biggie in the world of New Hampshire business. But I found him a changed man. He knew what lay before him, and his courage was superb. He asked for nothing. He regretted nothing. All the terror and nervousness which had possessed him so long as he was confronted by an unknown fate. Johnny had seen the ad for a tutor in the Maine Times and had applied without too much hope. He had moved down to Kittery in mid-February, needing more than anything else to get away from Pownall, from the box full of mail each day, the reporters who had begun to find their way to the house in ever-increasing numbers, the nervous women with the wounded eyes who had just dropped by because they just happened to be in the neighborhood. One of those who had just dropped by because she just happened to be in the neighborhood had a Maryland license plate. Another was driving a tired old Ford with Arizona tags, their hands stretching out to touch him. In Kittery, he discovered for the first time that an anonymous name like John No Middle Initial Smith had its advantages. His third day in town, he had applied for a job as a short order cook, putting down his experience in the UMO Commons and one summer cooking at a boys' camp in the Rangeley Lakes as experience. The diner's owner, a tough-as-nails widow named Ruby Pelletier, had looked over his application and said,
"You're a teensy bit overeducated for slinging hash. You know that, don't you, slugger?"
"That's right," Johnny said. "I went and educated myself right out of the job market." Ruby Pelletier put her hands on her scrawny hips, threw her head back, and bellowed laughter.
"You think you can keep your shit together at 2 in the morning when 12 CB cowboys pull in all at once and order scrambled eggs, bacon, sausage, French toast, and flapjacks?"
"I guess maybe," Johnny said.
"I guess maybe you don't know what the F I'm talking about just yet," Ruby said. "But I'll give you a go, college boy. Go get yourself a physical, so we're square with the Board of Health, and bring me back a clean bill. I'll put you right on."
He had done that, and after a harum-scarum first 2 weeks, which included a painful rash of blisters on his right hand from dropping a French fry basket into a well of boiling fat a little too fast. He had been writing the job instead of the other way around. When he saw Chatsworth's ad, he had sent his resume to the box number. In the course of the resume, he had listed his special ed credentials, which included a one-semester seminar in learning disabilities and reading problems. In late April, as he was finishing his second month at the diner, he had gotten a letter from Roger Chatsworth asking him to appear for an interview on May 5th. He made the necessary arrangements to take the day off, and at 2:10 on a lovely mid-spring afternoon, he'd been sitting in Chatsworth's study, a tall, ice-choked glass of Pepsi-Cola in one hand, listening to Stuart talk about his son's reading problems.
"That sound like dyslexia to you?" Stuart asked.
"No, it sounds like a general reading phobia." Chatsworth had winced a little.
"Jackson syndrome?"
Johnny had been impressed, as he was no doubt supposed to be. Michael Carey Jackson was a reading and grammar specialist from the University of Southern California who had caused something of a stir 9 years ago with a book called The Unlearning Reader. The book described a loose basket of reading problems that had since become known as Jackson syndrome. The book was a good one if you could get past the dense academic jargon. The fact that Chatsworth apparently had done so told Johnny a good deal about the man's commitment to solving his son's problem.
"Something like it," Johnny agreed, "but you understand I haven't even met your son yet or listened to him read."
"He's got coursework to make up from last year. American writers, a 9-week history block, and civics, of all things. He flunked his final exam there because he couldn't read the beastly thing. Have you got a New Hampshire's teacher certificate?"
"No," Johnny said, "but getting one is no problem."
"And how would you handle the situation?" Johnny outlined the way he would deal with it. A lot of oral reading on Chuck's part, leaning heavily on high-impact materials such as fantasy, science fiction, westerns, and boy meets car juvenile novels. Constant questioning on what had just been read, and a relaxation technique described in Jackson's book. "High achievers often suffer the most," Johnny said. "They try too hard and reinforce the block. It's a kind of mental stutter that..."
"Jackson says that?" Chatsworth interposed sharply.
Johnny smiled.
"No, I say that," he said.
"Okay, go on." "Sometimes, if the student can totally blank his mind right after reading and not feel the pressure to recite it back right away, the circuits seem to clear themselves. When that begins to happen, the student begins to rethink his line of attack. It's a positive thinking kind of thing." Chatsworth's eyes had gleamed. Johnny had just touched on the linchpin of his own personal philosophy, probably the linchpin for the beliefs of most self-made men.
"Nothing succeeds like success," he said. Well, yes, something like that. How long would it take you to get a New Hampshire certificate? No longer than it takes them to process my application. 2 weeks, maybe? Then you could start on the 20th? Johnny blinked. You mean I'm hired? If you want the job, you're hired. You can stay in the guest house. It'll keep the goddamn relatives at bay this summer, not to mention Chuck's friends. And I want him to really buckle down. I'll pay you $600 a month. Not a king's ransom, but if Chuck gets along, I'll pay you a substantial bonus. Substantial. Chatsworth removed his glasses and rubbed a hand across his face. I love my boy, Mr. Smith. I only want the best for him. Help us out a little if you can.
I'll try.
Chatsworth put his glasses back on and picked up Johnny's resume again. You haven't taught for a hell of a long time. Didn't agree with you? Here it comes, Johnny thought. It agreed, he said, but I was in an accident. Chatsworth's eyes had gone to the scars on Johnny's neck where the atrophied tendons had been partially repaired. Car crash? Yes. Bad one? Yes. You seem fine now, Chatsworth said. He picked up the resume, slammed it into a drawer, and amazingly, that had been the end of the questions. So after 5 years, Johnny was teaching again, although his student load was only one. 2. As for me, who had it indirectly brought his death upon him, he took my hand with a weak grip and smiled his forgiveness up to me. It was a hard moment, and I went away feeling that I had done more harm in the world than I could ever make up to it. Chuck snapped the book closed. There. Last one in the pool's a green banana. Hold it a minute, Chuck. Chuck sat down again heavily, his face composing itself into what Johnny already thought of as his now-the-questions expression. Long-suffering good humor predominated, but beneath it he could sometimes see another Chuck, sullen, worried, and scared. Plenty scared, because it was a reader's world. The unlettered of America were dinosaurs lumbering down a blind alley, and Chuck was smart enough to know it. And he was plenty afraid of what might happen to him when he got back to school this fall. Just a couple of questions, Chuck. Why bother? You know I won't be able to answer them. Oh, yes. This time you'll be able to answer them all. I can never understand what I read. You ought to know that by now. Chuck looked morose and unhappy. I don't even know what you stick around for, unless it's the chow. You'll be able to answer these questions because they're not about the book. Chuck glanced up. Not about the book? Then why ask him? I thought, just humor me, okay? Johnny's heart was pounding hard, and he was not totally surprised to find that he was scared. He had been planning this for a long time, waiting for just the right confluence of circumstances. This was as close as he was ever going to get. Mrs. Chatsworth was not hovering around anxiously, making Chuck that much more nervous. None of his buddies were splashing around in the pool, making him feel self-conscious about reading aloud like a backward fourth grader. And most important, his father, the man Chuck wanted to please above all others in the world, was not here. He was in Boston at a New England Environmental Commission meeting on water pollution. From Edward Stanny's An Overview of Learning Disabilities. The subject, Rupert J., was sitting in the third row of a movie theater. He was closest to the screen by more than 6 rows and was the only one in a position to observe that a small fire had started in the accumulated litter on the floor. Rupert J. stood up and cried, while the people behind him shouted for him to sit down and be quiet. How did that make you feel? I asked Rupert J. I could never explain in 1,000 years how it made me feel, he answered. I was scared. But even more than being scared, I was frustrated. I felt inadequate, not fit to be a member of the human race. The stuttering always made me feel that way, but now I felt impotent too. Was there anything else? Yes, I felt jealousy because someone else would see the fire and, you know, get the glory of reporting it? Yes, that's right. I saw the fire starting. I was the only one, and all I could say was, like a stupid broken record. Not fit to be a member of the human race describes it best. And how did you break the block? The day before had been my mother's birthday. I got her half a dozen roses at the florist, and I stood there with all of them yelling at me, and I thought, I'm going to open my mouth and scream roses, just as loud as I can. I got that word already. Then what did you do? I opened my mouth and screamed fire at the top of my lungs. It had been 8 years since Johnny had read that case history in the introduction to Stanny's text, but he had never forgotten it. He had always thought that the key word in Rupert J.'s recollection of what had happened was impotent. If you feel that sexual intercourse is the most important thing on earth at this point in time, your risk of coming up with a limp penis increases 10 or 100-fold. And if you feel that reading is the most important thing on earth, what's your middle name, Chuck? He asked casually. Murphy, Chuck said with a little grin. How's that for bad? My mother's maiden name. You tell Jack or Al that, and I'll be forced to do gross damage to your skinny body. No fear, Johnny said. When's your birthday? September 8th. Johnny began to throw the questions faster, not giving Chuck a chance to think. But they weren't questions you had to think about. What's your girl's name? Beth. You know Beth, Johnny. What's her middle name? Chuck grinned. Alma. Pretty horrible, right? What's your paternal grandfather's name? Richard. Who do you like in the American League East this year? Yankees. In a walk. Who do you like for president? I'd like to see Jerry Brown get it. You planning to trade that vet? Not this year, maybe next. Your mom's idea? You bet. She said it outraces her peace of mind. How did Red Hawk get past the guards and kill Danny Juniper? Sherburne didn't pay enough attention to that trap door leading into the jail attic, Chuck said promptly, without thinking, and Johnny felt a sudden burst of triumph that hit him like a knock of straight bourbon. It had worked. He'd gotten Chuck talking about roses, and he had responded with a good, healthy yell of fire. Chuck was looking at him in almost total surprise. Red Hawk got into the attic through the skylight, kicked open the trap door, shot Danny Juniper, shot Tom Kenyon, too. That's right, Chuck. I remembered, he muttered, and then looked up at Johnny, eyes widening, a grin starting at the corners of his mouth. You tricked me into remembering. I just took you by the hand and led you around the side of whatever has been in your way all this time, Johnny said. But whatever it is, it's still there, Chuck. Don't kid yourself. Who was the girl Sherburne fell for? It was... His eyes clouded a little, and he shook his head reluctantly. I don't remember. He struck his thigh with sudden viciousness. I can't remember anything. I'm so fucking stupid. Can you remember ever having been told how your dad and mom met? Chuck looked up at him and smiled a little. There was an angry red place on his thigh where he had struck himself. Sure. She was working for Avis down in Charleston, South Carolina. She rented my dad a car with a flat tire, Chuck laughed. She still claims she only married him because number two tries harder. And who was that girl Sherburne got interested in? Jenny Langhorne. Big time trouble for him. She's Gresham's girl, a redhead, like Beth. He broke off, staring at Johnny as if he had just produced a rabbit from the breast pocket of his shirt. You did it again! No, you did it. It's a simple trick of misdirection. Why do you say Jenny Langhorne is big time trouble for John Sherburne? Well, because Gresham's the big wheel there in that town. What town? Chuck opened his mouth, but nothing came out. Suddenly, he cut his eyes away from Johnny's face and looked at the pool. Then he smiled and looked back. Amity. The same as in the flick Jaws.
Good. How did you come up with the name?
Chuck grinned.
This makes no sense at all, but I started thinking about trying out for the swimming team, and there it was. What a trick. What a great trick.
Okay, that's enough for today, I think. Johnny felt tired, sweaty, and very, very good. You just made a breakthrough, in case you didn't notice. Let's swim. Last one in's a green banana.
Johnny?
What?
Will that always work?
If you make a habit of it, it will, Johnny said. And every time you go around that block, instead of trying to bust through the middle of it, you're going to make it a little smaller. I think you'll begin to see an improvement in your word-to-word reading before long also. I know a couple of other little tricks. He fell silent. What he had just given Chuck was less the truth than a kind of hypnotic suggestion.
Thanks, Chuck said. The mask of long-suffering good humor was gone, replaced by naked gratitude. If you get me over this, I guess I'll get down and kiss your feet if you wanted me to. Sometimes I get so scared I feel like I'm letting my dad down.
Chuck, don't you know that's part of the problem?
It is?
Yeah. You're over-swinging, overthrowing, over everything. And it may not be just a psychological block, you know? There are people who believe that some reading problems, Jackson syndrome, reading phobias, all of that, may be some kind of mental birthmark. A fouled circuit, a faulty relay, he shut his mouth with a snap.
A what? Chuck asked.
A dead zone, Johnny said slowly. Whatever. Names don't matter. Results do. The misdirection trick really isn't a trick at all. It's educating a fallow part of your brain to do the work of that small, faulty section. For you, that means getting into an oral-based train of thought every time you hit a snag. You're actually changing the location in your brain from which your thought is coming. It's learning to switch it.
But can I do it? You think I can do it?
I know you can, Johnny said.
All right, then I will.
Chuck dived low and flat into the pool and came up, shaking water out of his long hair and a fine spray of droplets.
Come on in, it's fine.
I will, Johnny said. But for the moment, he was content just to stand on the pool's tile facing and watch Chuck swim powerfully toward the pool's deep end and to savor the success. There had been no good feeling like this when he had suddenly known Eileen McGowan's kitchen curtains were taking fire. No good feeling like this when he had uncovered the name of Frank Dodd. If God had given him a talent, it was teaching, not knowing things he had no business knowing. This was the sort of thing he had been made for. And when he had been teaching at Cleves Mills back in 1970, he had known it. More important, the kids had known it and responded to it, as Chuck had done just now.
You gonna stand there like a dummy? Chuck asked.
Johnny dived into the pool.
Chapter 18. Warren Richardson came out of his small office building at 4:45 as he always did. He walked around to the parking lot and hoisted his 200-pound bulk behind the wheel of his Chevy Caprice and started the engine, all according to routine. What was not according to routine was the face that appeared suddenly in the rearview mirror. An olive-skinned, stubbled face framed by long hair and set off by eyes every bit as green as those of Sarah Hazlitt or Chuck Chatsworth. Warren Richardson had not been so badly scared since he was a kid, and his heart took a great, unsteady leap in his chest.
Howdy, said Sonny Elliman, leaning over the seat.
Who?
Was all Richardson managed, uttering the word in a terrified hiss of breath. His heart was pounding so hard that dark specks danced and pulsed before his eyes in rhythm with its beat. He was afraid he might have a heart attack.
Easy, the man who had been hiding in his back seat said. Go easy, man. Lighten up.
And Warren Richardson felt an absurd emotion. It was gratitude. The man who had scared him wasn't going to scare him anymore. He must be a nice man. He must be... Who are you? He managed this time.
A friend, Sonny said.
Richardson started to turn,
and fingers as hard as pincers bit into the sides of his flabby neck. The pain was excruciating. Richardson drew breath in a convulsive, heaving whine.
You don't need to turn around, man. You can see me as well as you need to see me in your rear view. Can you dig that?
Yes, Richardson gasped. Yes, 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 just let go. The pincers began to ease up, and again he felt that irrational sense of gratitude. But he no longer doubted that the man in the back seat was dangerous, or that he was in this car on purpose, although he couldn't think why anyone would. And then he could think why someone would, at least why someone might. It wasn't the sort of thing you'd expect any ordinary candidate for office to do, but Greg Stilson wasn't ordinary. Greg Stilson was a crazy man, and very softly, Warren Richardson began to blubber.
Gotta talk to you, man, Sonny said.
His voice was kind and regretful, but in the rearview mirror, his eyes glittered green amusement.
Gotta talk to you like a Dutch uncle.
It's Stilson, isn't it? It's... The pincers were suddenly back. The man's fingers were buried in his neck, and Richardson uttered a high-pitched shriek.
No names,
the terrible man in the back seat told him in that same kind yet regretful voice.
You draw your own conclusions, Mr. Richardson, but keep the names to yourself. I've got one thumb just over your carotid artery, and my fingers are over by your jugular, and I can turn you into a human turnip if I want to.
What do you want? Richardson asked. He did not exactly moan, but it was a near thing. He had never felt more like moaning in his life. He could not believe that this was happening in the parking lot behind his real estate office in Capital City, New Hampshire, on a bright summer's day. He could see the clock set into the red brick of the town hall tower. It said 5:10. At home, Norma would be putting the pork chops, nicely coated with shake and bake, into the oven to broil. Sean would be watching Sesame Street on TV. And there was a man behind him, threatening to cut off the flow of blood to his brain and turn him into an idiot. No, it wasn't real. It was like a nightmare, the sort of nightmare that makes you moan in your sleep.
I don't want anything, Sonny Elliman said. It's all a matter of what you want.
I don't understand what you're talking about. But he was terribly afraid that he did.
That story in the New Hampshire Journal about funny real estate deals, Sonny said. You surely did have a lot to say, Mr. Richardson, didn't you? Especially about certain people. That stuff about the Capitol Mall, for instance. Hinting around about kickbacks and payoffs and one hand washing the other. All that horse shit.
The fingers tightened on Richardson's neck again, and this time he did moan. But he hadn't been identified in the story. He had just been an informed source. How had they known? How had Greg Stilson known? The man behind him began to speak rapidly into Warren Richardson's ear now, his breath warm and ticklish.
You could get certain people into trouble talking horseshit like that, Mr. Richardson. You know it? People running for public office, let's say. Running for office, it's like playing bridge, you dig it? You're vulnerable. People can sling mud and it sticks, especially these days. Now, there's no trouble yet. I'm happy to tell you that, because if there was trouble, you might be sitting here picking your teeth out of your nose instead of having a nice little talk with me.
In spite of his pounding heart, in spite of his fear, Richardson said, This person, young man, you're crazy if you think you can protect him. He's played it as fast and loose as a snake oil salesman in a southern town. Sooner or later, a thumb slammed into his ear, grinding. The pain was immense, unbelievable. Richardson's head slammed into his window and he cried out. Blindly, he groped for the horn ring.
You blow that horn, I'll kill you, the voice whispered.
Richardson let his hands drop. The thumb eased up.
You ought to use Q-tips in there, man, the voice said.
I got wax all over my thumb. Pretty gross.
Warren Richardson began to cry weakly. He was powerless to stop himself. Tears coursed down his fat cheeks.
Please don't hurt me anymore, he said. Please don't. Please.
It's like I said, Sonny told him. It's all a matter of what you want. Your job isn't to worry what someone else might say about these certain people. Your job is to watch what comes out of your own mouth. Your job is to think before you talk the next time that guy from the journal comes around. You might think about how easy it is to find out who an informed source is. Or you might think about what a bummer it would be if your house burned down. Or you might think about how you'd pay for plastic surgery if someone threw some battery acid in your wife's face.
The man behind Richardson was panting now. He sounded like an animal in a jungle.
Or you might think, you know, dig it, how easy it would be for someone to come along and pick up your son on his way home from kindergarten.
Don't you say that,
Richardson cried hoarsely.
Don't you say that, you slimy bastard.
All I'm saying is that you want to think about what you want, Sonny said. An election, it's an all-American thing, you know. Especially in a bicentennial year. Everyone should have a good time. No one has a good time if dumb fucks like you start telling a lot of lies. Numb, jealous fucks like you.
The hand went away altogether. The rear door opened. Oh, thank God, thank God.
You just want to think, Sonny Elliman repeated. Now do we have an understanding?
Yes. Richardson whispered. But if you think a certain person can be elected using these tactics, you're badly mistaken.
No, Sonny said. You're the one who's mistaken. Because everyone's having a good time. Make sure that you're not left out.
Richardson didn't answer. He sat rigid behind the steering wheel, his neck throbbing, staring at the clock on the town office building. As if it were the only sane thing left in his life. It was now almost 5 of 5. The pork chops would be in by now. The man in the back seat said one more thing, and then he was gone, striding away rapidly, his long hair swinging against the collar of his shirt, not looking back. He went around the corner of the building and out of sight. The last thing he had said to Warren Richardson was,
Q-tips.
Richardson began to shake all over, and it was a long time before he could drive. His first clear feeling was anger, terrible anger. The impulse that came with it was to drive directly to the Capital City Police Department, housed in the building below the clock, and report what had happened, the threats on his wife and son, the physical abuse, and on whose behalf it had been done.
You might think about how you'd pay for plastic surgery. Or how easy it would be for someone to come along and pick up your son.
But why? Why take the chance? What he had said to that thug was just the plain, unvarnished truth. Everyone in southern New Hampshire real estate knew that Stilson had been running a shell game, reaping short-term profits that would land him in jail, not sooner or later, but sooner or even sooner. His campaign was an exercise in idiocy. And now strong-arm tactics. No one could get away with that for long in America, and especially not New England. But let someone else blow the whistle. Someone with less to lose. Warren Richardson started his car and went home to his pork chops and said nothing at all. Someone else would surely put a stop to it. Chapter 19 1. On a day not long after Chuck's first breakthrough, Johnny Smith stood in the bathroom of the guest house, running his Norelco over his cheeks. Looking at himself close up in the mirror always gave him a weird feeling these days, as if he were looking at an older brother instead of himself. Deep horizontal lines had grooved themselves across his forehead. Two more bracketed his mouth. Strangest of all, there was that streak of white, and the rest of his hair was beginning to go gray. It seemed to have started almost overnight.
He snapped off the razor and went out into the combination kitchen living room. Lap of luxury, he thought, and smiled a little. Smiling was starting to feel natural again. He turned on the TV, got a Pepsi out of the fridge, and settled down to watch the news. Roger Chatsworth was due back later in the evening, and tomorrow Johnny would have the distinct pleasure of telling him that his son was beginning to make real progress. Johnny had been up to see his own father every 2 weeks or so. He was pleased with Johnny's new job, and listened with keen interest as Johnny told him about the Chatsworths, the house in the pleasant college town of Durham, and Chuck's problems. Johnny, in turn, listened as his father told him about the gratis work he was doing at Charlene McKenzie's house in neighboring New Gloucester.
Her husband was a hell of a doctor, but not much of a handyman, Herb said.
Charlene and Vera had been friends before Vera's deepening involvement in the stranger offshoots of fundamentalism. That had separated them. Her husband, a GP, had died of a heart attack in 1973.
Place was practically falling down around the woman's ears, Herb said. Least I could do. I go up on Saturdays and she gives me a dinner before I come back home. I have to tell the truth, Johnny. She cooks better than you do.
Looks better, too, Johnny said blandly.
Sure, she's a fine-looking woman, but it's nothing like that, Johnny. Your mother not even in her grave a year.
But Johnny suspected that maybe it was something like that, and secretly couldn't have been more pleased. He didn't fancy the idea of his father growing old alone. On the television, Walter Cronkite was serving up the evening's political news. Now, with the primary season over and the conventions only weeks away, it appeared that Jimmy Carter had the Democratic nomination sewed up. It was Ford who was in a scrap for his political life with Ronald Reagan, the ex-governor of California and ex-host of GE Theater. It was close enough to have the reporters counting individual delegates, and in one of her infrequent letters, Sarah Hazlitt had written,
"Walt's got his fingers and toes crossed that Ford gets it. As a candidate for state senate up here, he's already thinking about coattails, and he says that, in Maine at least, Reagan hasn't any."
While he was short order cooking in Kittery, Johnny had gotten into the habit of going down to Dover or Portsmouth or any number of smaller surrounding towns in New Hampshire a couple of times a week. All of the candidates for president were in and out, and it was a unique opportunity to see those who were running close up and without the nearly regal trappings of authority that might later surround any one of them. It became something of a hobby, although of necessity a short-lived one. When New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary was over, the candidates would move on to Florida without a glance back, and of course a few of their number would bury their political ambitions somewhere between Portsmouth and Keene. Never a political creature before, except during the Vietnam era, Johnny became an avid politician watcher in the healing aftermath of the Castle Rock business, and his own particular talent, affliction, whatever it was, played a part in that too. He shook hands with Morris Udall and Henry Jackson. Fred Harris clapped him on the back. Ronald Reagan gave him a quick and practiced politico's double pump and said, "Get out to the polls and help us if you can." Johnny had nodded agreeably enough, seeing no point in disabusing Mr. Reagan of his notion that he was a bona fide New Hampshire voter. He had chatted with Sarge Shriver just inside the main entrance to the monstrous Newington Mall for nearly 15 minutes. Shriver, his hair freshly cut and smelling of aftershave and perhaps desperation, was accompanied by a single aide with his pockets stuffed full of leaflets and a Secret Service man who kept scratching furtively at his acne. Shriver had seemed inordinately pleased to be recognized. A minute or two before Johnny said goodbye, a candidate in search of some local office had approached Shriver and asked him to sign his nominating papers. Shriver had smiled gently. Johnny had sensed things about all of them, but little of a specific nature. It was as if they had made the act of touching such a ritual thing that their true selves were buried beneath a layer of tough, clear lucite. Although he saw most of them, with the exception of President Ford, Johnny had felt only once that sudden, electrifying snap of knowledge that he associated with Eileen McGowan, and in an entirely different way with Frank Dodd. It was 7:15 in the morning. Johnny had driven down to Manchester in his old Plymouth. He had worked from 10 the evening before until 6 this morning. He was tired, but the quiet winter dawn had been too good to sleep through. And he liked Manchester. Manchester with its narrow streets and time-worn brick buildings, the Gothic textile mills strung along the river like mid-Victorian beads. He had not been consciously politician hunting that morning. He thought he would cruise the streets for a while until they began to get crowded, until the cold and silent spell of February was broken, then go back to Kittery and catch some sack time. He turned a corner, and there had been 3 nondescript sedans pulled up in front of a shoe factory in a no-parking zone. Standing by the gate in the cyclone fencing was Jimmy Carter, shaking hands with the men and women going on shift. They were carrying lunch baskets or paper sacks, breathing out white clouds, bundled into heavy coats, their faces still asleep. Carter had a word for each of them. His grin, then not so publicized as it became later, was tireless and fresh. His nose was red with the cold. Johnny parked half a block down and walked toward the factory gate, his shoes crunching and squeaking on the packed snow. The Secret Service agent with Carter sized him up quickly and then dismissed him, or seemed to.
"I'll vote for anyone who's interested in cutting taxes," a man in an old ski parka was saying. The parka had a constellation of what looked like battery acid burns in one sleeve. "The goddamn taxes are killing me, I kid you not."
"Well, we're going to see about that," Carter said. "Looking over the tax situation is going to be one of our first priorities when I get into the White House."
There was a serene self-confidence in his voice that struck Johnny and made him a little uneasy. Carter's eyes, bright and almost amazingly blue, shifted to Johnny. "Hi there," he said. "Hello, Mr. Carter," Johnny said. "I don't work here. I was driving by and saw you."
"Well, I'm glad you stopped. I'm running for president."
"I know." Carter put his hand out. Johnny shook it. Carter began,
"I hope you'll..."
and broke off. The flash came, a sudden, powerful zap that was like sticking his fingers in an electric socket. Carter's eyes sharpened. He and Johnny looked at each other for what seemed a very long time.